Okay, so today we're going to talk about evolution, and in specific, evolutionary biology. If you are a major who's on a catalog within the last few years, you do have to take a capstone course in evolution in the class, so we're not going to cover it extensively. We'll give you some of the main themes, and then when you get to the evolution course, 297, then you'll spend a lot of time looking over this. Although 297 is going away as a capstone class with the new catalogs that we've got degree sequences that are coming up, and this course is the International Sign for Degree Sequences. I sat in too many faculty meetings where we talked about a broad core and then more specific tracks, and so that's, sorry, why I do that. And each individual sequence or degree program is going to be able to come up with their own capstone course. So the more ecological ones will keep evolution. I think cell and molecular biology is going to have a slightly different capstone course. But my guess is you guys are all going to have to take evolution if you get your degree from ISU in the next couple of years. And if you don't want to ask me after class when the microphone is off how you can get around that. So this is a quote that is beaten into the ground by biologists. Nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution. And to a large extent, that was the idea of the framework of the curriculum in the School of Biological Sciences. There's a lot of mechanisms that take place. We've covered a lot of mechanisms in this class. I've said multiple times that mutation is a random process, but selection is anything but random. And so evolution combines those random mechanisms that we see in molecular biology, molecular genetics, and it couples them with the highly selective nature of ecological systems. So evolution is genetic change taking place in a group of organisms over time. Okay. I've got a colleague that says individual organisms don't evolve, populations do. As a bacterial geneticist, I don't always agree with that. We've seen horizontal transfer and how horizontal transfer is often facilitated in stressful times. So I think a bacterium can, in fact, evolve that to better suit its environment in a short period of time. But for the most part, when we're talking about evolution, we're talking about genetic change in a group of organisms over a period of time. And ultimately, we can track this back now that we've got molecular tools to this, including genetic changes. So we see, typically in a multicellular organism, we see a physiological manifestation, but we can track back that change to genetic events, changes in the nucleotide sequence, or changes in the timing or the expression of genes. Okay, remember, it's just not a matter of if you've got a gene, yes or no, it's a matter of the timing and the magnitude of the expression. So what we'll see is an evolution in the gene pool or changes in the gene pool. The genetic material that they have available to them as a group is what will really be tracked during evolution. Oh, there's a lot of terminology associated with evolutionary biology. Actually, my PhD is in genetics, but it was extensively in evolutionary genetics, and so some of this feels really comfortable to me. Most of it will be really painful to you, so I'll try and skim over a lot of this. So some of the terminology we've got, anagenesis, which is evolution taking place within a single group, as opposed to all the representative groups of an organism undergoing kind of comparable evolution. We really just have one line of the family tree that undergoes changes. Cladogenesis, I'd like you to know. Clade is a word that evolutionary biologists use a lot. And clade basically means a branch of the evolutionary tree, of the family tree of an organism. And so when you've got cladogenesis, that just means that you've got the splitting of one lineage into two, that you've got a change that's enough that now you've got two different populations that have that are there when you just had one fairly constant population before. And we'll talk about how this happens, particularly with respect to new species, that there's a couple different main mechanisms by which that can happen. When we draw phylogenetic maps, we're basically drawing something that looks like either a family tree or it looks like the NCAA tournament draw, where you've got a line, and this line may change over time, but everyone within that population is changing in much the same way. So if you've got anagenesis, we're not saying that if you, this is, as we're going up in time, okay, the vertical aspect is time. This reflects evolution as changes in genes or in physiological traits. Even though we just have a single line here, we're not saying if you look at a representative at this point of time that they're exactly like this one. What we are saying that as a group, they're staying pretty constant within the group, and any change is reflected in the group as a whole, that there's no dramatic variation within that group. And when you get cladogenesis, there's a dramatic change that takes place within that group, so that from that point on, you really can't identify them as a single homogenous group anymore. You've got two different groups that are distinct based on one or more traits, and so we just split off the line here, showing that now we've got two different populations. And so when you look at, this is referred to as a phylogenetic map. Or a phylogenetic tree, or sometimes they're just referred to as phylogeny. When you're looking at the evolutionary history of a population, okay, and you know, there's a little kink in the line here. So we're basically saying that this original population stops or ceases to exist if there's a kink in the line. If this would just go out, keep going out straight, then we would assume that that population is still intact, but this one is an offshoot of that. Whenever you get an angle off of both of them, we're saying that this original population doesn't exist anymore. Okay, so some of the ways that we can measure variation at the molecular level, the first is protein variation. And this is actually a pretty nice way to do it. Okay, so it's mechanistically, it's tough to sequence the amino acids in a protein. You can do it. You can isolate a protein. You can fragment it. Subject it to mass spec. There's a process called Edman degradation you can do. It's pretty pricey, and the number of amino acids that you get is limited. So when we talk about sequencing proteins, what we're really doing is sequencing the genes that encode proteins and predicting what the amino acid sequence would be from the open reading frame sequence of the gene. Okay. And then once you do that, then you compare the amino acid sequence of the predicted proteins. Okay. And in doing so, you've got genetic variation. Okay. So, let's go to an easier one. So when you do that, and you come up with different predictions of amino acid, okay, we talked about mutations and the types of mutations that you can have, and that some of them are silent mutations, right, where you can change the nucleotide, but you don't change the amino acid. Others, you change an amino acid, but if it's the same isofunctional group, you really don't change the activity of a protein. Okay, if you make a dramatic change in amino acid, you'll change the activity of a protein. And so what some of these look at is what types of mutations not only will occur, but once they occur, which ones won't be selected against. So you would expect to find them in the population. And a large number of these are neutral mutations. That is, they have no overall effect on the activity of a protein. If you swap out one hydrophobic amino acid for another hydrophobic amino acid, the changes that that has in the three-dimensional shape of the protein and its activity are limited. And so you can get two versions of the protein encoded by two different genes in two different populations, and the activity of that protein could be essentially the same. Okay? And so there's no selection against those types of mutations. As a result, when we look at populations through time, many of the mutations that we can track as changes in their DNA are neutral mutations. Okay? If you go through and you try to find a bunch of detrimental mutations over time, you've got to catch them as a snapshot. You've got to find a detrimental mutation shortly after it happened, because by definition, if it's detrimental, it's a bad thing. They tend to be selected out. So when we're doing this long-term view of a population over time, looking at its evolutionary history, the ones that we tend to see are predominantly neutral mutations. There's a hypothesis called the balance hypothesis, and that is there's a selection for genetic variation. There's no organism on the planet that has a perfect DNA polymerase or perfect editing. Mismatch repair, there are always going to be mistakes. In a lab, we can engineer DNA polymerases that are much better than the ones that you find in nature. We can engineer DNA polymerases that make mistakes about 1,000-fold less frequently than the natural ones. That suggests that there's been selection on DNA polymerases to occasionally make mistakes, to allow mutation, and then the environment determines whether that mutation is beneficial or detrimental. But there's this... it flies in the face of the argument about creation science, that things were made, they were made perfectly. If I was an engineer and I made something perfect, I would not give it a bad DNA polymerase and I would not put it in a competitive environment. The two things that even a lumpy middle-aged professor knows will result in selection through, or evolution through selection. So there's this... it's referred to as cannibalization. There is a range of error rate of DNA polymerases that tends to be favored within a population. If we go in and we tweak the genes that encode DNA polymerase and we make them really faulty, those individuals tend to be selected against over several generations. If we make the DNA polymerase so that it tends to be really good and then we put the population under stressful conditions, those individuals tend to be selected out. So there's this narrow range of fidelity for DNA polymerases. By the, you know, for the most part, they do their job well, but they screw up from time to time, and that range of errors that they make is in a range that's favorable for the population. May not be great for the next generation of individuals, but for the long-term health and evolution of the population, that variability is selected for. Okay. Some other ways that we can look at variation in DNA, aside from looking at the genes that encode proteins, the first is restriction site variation. Okay. What this means is we use restriction enzymes. Okay, I think I've talked about them in here once or twice. Restriction enzymes are the immune system of a bacterium, that they cut up viral DNA at specific sequences. We could use those enzymes and take your DNA, or we can take another organism, and we cut the genome up and look at a banding pattern. The number and size of the fragments that are produced by cutting a DNA molecule by a specific restriction enzyme. And if there's a mutation that results in a change at one of those recognition sequences, we'll see a different banding pattern. So if you watch NCI or shows like that, if they ever talk about DNA fingerprinting, What they're really talking about is looking, one of the ways that they do DNA fingerprinting is through restriction site variation. That there are about 80 sites in the human genome where there's a fair amount of variation from individual to individual in the presence or absence of some of these restriction sites. So they go through and they take a DNA sample from a crime scene, they take a DNA sample from a suspect, they cut them individually, they set up 80 tubes and they cut it with those enzymes, and then they look at the banding patterns and compare them to see. And for each one of those, there's a certain amount of variability across the population, and by doing a large number of those experiments, you can make it very unlikely that it's somebody else. So with those 80 sites with unique banding patterns, you could basically get it down to a 1 in 12 billion chance that two people have the same banding pattern. And right now you live in a planet that there are about 7 billion people. So it makes it really tight if you get unique banding patterns from that full panel of 80 different restriction sites that are unique among the, or more variable across the human genome. Another location that they do are microsatellite variation. Microsatellites are regions near the end of chromosomes that are highly repetitive, but they're not in the telomeres, but they're telomere-associated oftentimes. And the number of repeats in those repetitive elements can vary significantly from one person to another. So if it's a 10-nucleotide sequence that's repeated, if you've got 26 repeats and I've got 12, we would be able to distinguish those by looking at that variation. Okay? But it's a similar idea that there are several locations across the genome of microsatellite variation, so you build up multiple experiments to come up with unique profiles for individual. And then there's variation detected by DNA sequencing. Okay? When this book was written, that was kind of an expensive, it was a follow-up test that you could do. You would generally start out with some of these restriction sites or repetitive region tests. It's now to the point that if you give a company a few thousand dollars, you can sequence an entire genome. And so the advent of, very soon forensics labs are just going to do entire genome sequencing from samples. And so this other sort of methodology is going to go away in the next 10 to 15 years. And if you ever commit a crime, like now, if you commit a crime and they keep your fingerprints on file, if you commit a crime in the future, they're going to take a DNA sample and your DNA will always be on file. If you commit another crime and leave a drop of blood around and they can extract some DNA from it, they'll be able to pin you down by your DNA sequence. So if you choose a life of crime, be very good and make sure that you bleach the site and don't leave blood drops and fingerprints around. If you choose to. I'm not telling you to do that as a career path, but unlike the old phrase, crime does in fact pay, it pays really well if you're good at it. But if you're bad at it, you're going to be on a bad reality show with your pants hanging around your knees, sitting in the county lockup, wondering what went wrong. All right. New species. This is something that very few people doubt the existence of microevolution. Okay? I can take somebody, bring them into my lab, take two populations of bacteria, expose one to a really forgiving environment, give them a lot of food, give them the optimal temperature. I take the same starting material of bacteria, put them in another environment, I stress them with pH or antibiotics or something like that. I do that for about 10 days. I could pull out those cells and I could identify that there is a difference in those two populations genetically. Okay? So microevolution happens. It happens in real time. It happens all the time. It's happening in your gut and the back of your throat right now as we speak. But where people have problems is how do you get the different species that arise, if that seems like a really dramatic thing. And it It is. We're oftentimes not talking about a single nucleotide change. Depending on how you define a species, we're talking about either a gross physiological trait, or we're talking about the ability to breed successfully, or just the way that something appears or lives its life. So for two organisms to be different species, there has to be a little bit more significant difference than for two individuals to be variable within the same population. Okay, so the idea of speciation, we'll talk about it for a bit. With molecular tools, this definition is a little bit, it's not as dogmatically followed, not as stringently followed as it used to be, but the old definition of a species used to be a group of organisms whose members are capable of interbreeding with one another, but are reproductively isolated from members of the other species. Okay. So, if you've got one species, pretty much anybody within any mating pair within that population should successfully be able to mate. If then you try to mate a robin and a sparrow, that's not going to work out well. That genetically, there are enough variations that they can't successfully mate. And so for a long period of time, that was the definition of species. And I'm a bacterial geneticist, so bacteria don't get it on very often, and so this rule doesn't apply to half the biomass of the planet. But one of the ideas of speciation is that there has to be some sort of isolating mechanism. The only way that you could go from having one population that could successfully breed with each other and any mating pair to two populations that can no longer breed, there's got to be some isolating mechanism. And it could either be ecological, behavioral, temporal, mechanical. So physically, you can isolate two populations and keep them isolated so that they evolve independently. And over time, they'll evolve in different ways so that there are enough genetic variations that they can no longer successfully breed. Okay, and so the most common way is through geological barriers. Okay, but there are some, temporal just means by time. If you separate populations by time, where maybe they migrate through the same area, but they migrate at a different time, that they will evolve independently of each other to the point that they can no longer interbreed, and at that point they become two different species. Okay. And that brings us then to the term allopatric speciation. This is the most common. This is where a geographical barrier splits a population, and it isolates them for a long enough period of time that they evolve into two separate species. Okay. So here we've got one original population, and then we've got, poof, a mountain range pops up. Okay. One of the things that you always have to keep in mind is in evolution, when we're talking about dramatic differences, we are talking about generally long periods of time. We're not thinking in terms of a typical biological period of time. We tend to be thinking more in terms of geological periods of time. Okay, so we've got now a mountain range that springs up, and our population is split in two, separated by the mountain range. And at this point, this population acquires some genetic variation, and there'll be selection based on what's going on this side of the mountain. This population is undergoing the same thing. The selection, even if the selection is the same, even if there is exactly the same conditions on the two sides of the mountain range, the specific nucleotide changes in the genetic variation may not be the same. And so you've got two different populations that evolve independently, and then they come into contact again, and you might in fact have members of each of the populations that strongly resemble each other, But due to genetic variation, if they can't interbreed at that point, you've got two separate species. Okay? So allopatric speciation always depends on that idea of a geological or geographical barrier. The hallmark Darwin's origin of species through natural selection, he looked at birds in the Galapagos Islands and looked at finches, and in particular, he focused on variation among their beaks. And so populations on each of the island, finches don't really move from island to island if there's much water in between them. They were isolated, and over time, they evolved independent of one another to the point that he had a large number of species that all had a common ancestor when the Galapagos were a single landmass or close to a single landmass. Okay, and this is just showing some of the examples of what he's got with the variation in the beak shape and size. Okay. But they just had enough time independent of each other that there was selection for variation in the beak depending on the specific food material on that island. Okay. There's another model of speciation called sympatric. Allopatric is very well accepted among evolutionary biologists. We see examples of it all the time where populations are split by, you know, glaciers as they advance, by rivers that widen over time, and so it makes it impossible for populations to move across the river. We see allopatric speciation as a or the mechanism of allopatric speciation. Sympatric, it's a little bit tougher to grasp. It's tougher to identify because in this we're really, we've got to look for more subtle changes. And so we don't have any big geographic barrier to prevent gene flow. It's got to be some other mechanism. And the mechanism that seems to be the easiest to track for sympatric speciation is through time, changes in timing of organisms. Oop. Let's see. And so here's an example of an insect. The example that they have are, the best ones so far are flies and small bees, not like honeybees, but smaller bees. And they would tend to come to a range or to a site and breed. And then something happened with part of the population where they started showing up a little bit later and a little bit later all the time. And so you went from everybody coming and all hell was breaking loose in the mating game, but everybody in the population was there mating at one time. And it got to the point that this one group was delaying and delaying and to the point that they no longer overlapped. One group would come, have their mating season, and then the second population would come and have their mating season. Even though genetically, up to that point, they were a unified, homogeneous population, once they quit breeding with each other, they became two isolated populations. And any variation that took place in the first population, as long as their offspring were still early breeders, that variation would never be mixed in with the second population of late breeders. And so we refer to that as a temporal barrier, that they were divided by time. They made it at the same place. They had largely the same conditions, but just something happened where this one population started showing up later in the game and they became isolated that way. And eventually they evolved enough that interbreeding became a problem. This population that's being studied in real time, they're still largely successful at interbreeding with each other, but if you take two individuals from within a population, they could breed at about 95% success rates. Right now what they're seeing between the two populations is about a 70% success rate. So it's not to the point where they're truly two species yet, but we can see in a fairly short number of years that they're becoming isolated, and at this rate it won't be long before they are two species that are isolated reproductively. Speciation through polyploidy. This is much more common in plants. Remember, polyploidy is when you get extra sets of chromosomes. With plants, it's fairly common for them to be able to maintain an entire extra set of chromosome. And so if you get crossbreeding between closely related organisms, what will happen is their chromosomes won't always resolve well, and then you can have a new species that picks up an entire new set or more of chromosomes. And as a result, it has dramatically different properties to it. Okay. Well, and this is just showing an example of that where we've got two fairly closely related organisms, but you get fusion, and then eventually you get, after non-disjunction, you would get a 4N organism instead of these 2N parents. And that's viable, and it has different-looking seed heads. And most of the work that's done on this are done on either grasses or grains. Not surprisingly, the plants that we understand the best are the ones that are commercially most important. But the sort of backside of that genetically is the reason why rice and corn and wheat are most important to us financially is because they were the ones that were most easy to manipulate in terms of early agriculture. If you were trying to select for the best food source, if you were an early farmer and you had, you know, rice that you could see the next season was putting out better seed heads, you would grow rice. If you tried to do that with other grasses that weren't didn't show that much change over time, you would give up on them. So what we do know is the agricultural crops that we work with tend to be the plants that are the easiest to manipulate certain features based on the number of genes. Jared Diamond's book, it's like Germs, Guns, and Steel. And one of the things that he looks at is the difference between the Americas and Eurasia. And in the Americas, you have a long axis going north to south. And in Eurasia, you have a very long axis going east to west. And so the idea that you would have a larger area of organisms that would all grow at about the same latitude would be more useful in spreading across Eurasia than they would across the Americas. Okay? In America, we've got more of our range is latitude, less of it is longitude. In Eurasia, you get a large area across the same latitude. But the other thing that he looked at, for example, were almonds. The original form of almonds contain a cyanide-like substance that's generally not good to eat. And the number of genes that it would take to go from the original ancestor of an almond to the one that we grow now as a food source, it was like 7 genes had to change for that almond. He compared that with like oak trees with acorns. Acorns have a lot of tannic acid and some non-palatable things. The number of genes that would have to mutate for all of a sudden that we're going to the store and buying chocolate-covered acorns, it would take about 30 genes to be altered to make an acorn palatable. And so plants on Eurasia just had fewer genes to be manipulated, so they became the ones that were, by and large, the one that promoted agriculture early. There are a few in the Americas, tomatoes, so the nightshade family, tomatoes, peppers, and then also corn are sort of the big ones. But the number of genes that need to be manipulated in a plant determines how useful it is agriculturally. Genetic differentiation associated with speciation. So once we got molecular tools and we could look at differences in DNA, scientists love to cubbyhole things. Okay? We like nice, clean answers, and we wanted this rule. Okay, once we find a certain amount of genetic variation between two groups of organisms, we'd love to be able to draw a line and make that a species. Okay? A species barrier. And they've tried to do that, and it's not always clean. There is no universal answer. There are some species that you can have variation within 200 genes and they're the same species. there are two, there are in some cases where there are two different species and there are only 10 genes different between them. Okay? So part of it is it's this balancing act that evolutionary biologists do between gross physiological features, between their lifestyle, and between the molecular information that we have. With bacterium, it is a nightmare. Bacterial nomenclature and speciation is just a disaster. And part of that is a result of that horizontal transfer that takes place. That you can have a bacterium that picks up 12 genes on a plasmid, and that's 1% of its genome changes in 20 minutes' time. And everything else about it is exactly the same as the bacterium that was right beside it, except for what was on that plasmid. And so they tried balancing the old species rules with bacteria with the new molecular rules, and they got some really odd situations. E. coli and Salmonella are even different genera. It's not even a matter of the species. Their genus are different. Some E. coli strains and some Salmonella strains are about 96% identical at the DNA level. E. coli and, causes dysentery. Shigella. So Shigella dysenteriae and E. coli are identical except for four genes. And they're completely different genus nomenclature in bacteria. There are cases of some bacteria being in the same species that have up to 75% difference in their genome. That would basically be the same as you and a lemur being in the same species. So whenever you see a bacterial genus and species name, just take it with a grain of salt. That part of that is history, but they change all the time, and so the rules of the game with bacteria are different. With large eukaryotic organisms, they tend to change more slowly over time, and so the tweaking of the rules, it seems to be more consistent. But you want to use classification systems that incorporates lifestyle, physiology, and uses this genetic information to round that out. You don't want to rely entirely on genetic information, but it's a good starting point. Many people, when they get this genetic information, they use that as the basis to do a phylogeny, one of those maps demonstrating an evolutionary relation. This is an example you hear about a lot, that talking about the relative identity. One of the classic examples, humans and chimps are more closely related than zebras and horses are. So here we've got zebras up here. Here we've got domestic horses. This is showing the phylogeny. This is the common ancestor. And when you get this first division in the phylogenetic map, that's the first speciation event. And then you draw lines to separate them. These vertical lines don't mean anything. When you look at a phylogenetic map, what you're really looking for is the horizontal component. Okay, is showing the degree of divergence, or we can actually take that and calculate it as a unit of time if we have enough information. But we've got a branch point, and then we've got this relatively short one, and then we've got another divergence. And that's showing that pretty soon after this first one, we had a second event. Okay, after this first one, we've got this one type of horse that has essentially gone a long period of time with very little variation, and then very recently we had this divergence between domestic horses and Pyrzowski. And so the position of these is showing a speciation event. Okay. These individuals that are present here, the common ancestor, all of these horizontal lines, they don't have to be in existence anymore. It was just at some point there was a common ancestor and there was divergence into a horse and a domestic horse and this more wild, rare horse. Okay. So the idea that you don't always see those intermediate species or individuals is, okay, you just have to be comfortable with that fact. That there are changes that take place in selection that could select out these organisms. We can find a lot of them in the fossil records, but what you see at the end of a phylogenetic map are organisms that are present now. And so they're basically showing how they've evolved over time with this series of divergences. But you can go back and these two would be considered very close relatives. The horses down here would be a close relative. The distance that you follow out before you get to the divergence determines how close they are. So here in the zebras, most of them would be very close. And then you get the wild ass and the mountain ass. It's actually a long way before you get those divergences back to the common ancestors between zebras and asses. So following the horizontal aspect of the line gives you an idea of the relative relatedness of these individuals. But that would be an example of a phylogenetic map. And the way that they're constructed oftentimes is through a few different things. The parsimony approach is looking at the minimum number of evolutionary changes. So if I just gave you all of these organisms and told you, okay, they're all unique, but you need to go and assemble a map, the way that it was done in the past was there'd be a lot of physiological study. Okay, what's the height versus length ratio, what's the head size, what's the hoof diameter, that you would physiologically look or anatomically look at as many traits as you could and try to come up with ratios that distinguish each of these organisms and then find the ones that were more similar between two different groups and come up with a map that would come up with the fewest number of divergent events. Now we're doing that with a molecular approach. There are a few ways that you could do this. Let me make sure that that's what's showing up. Nope. So in this phylogenetic map, this is actually a pretty accurate map showing what's going on in the great apes. We've not included the orangutans on here. But there was a common ancestor, gorillas, split off. There was a common ancestor for humans and chimps. And then this divergence happened more recently. If you look at these three, it would be possible to draw this map with humans coming off and then gorillas and chimps being a divergence with chimps coming off on their own and humans and gorillas having a divergence. But when we look at genetic information, this is the map that comes up best using DNA sources and using some lifestyle events. But physiologically, if you just look physiologically, you would have humans as a separate group and chimps and gorillas coming off to the side. So the advent of molecular tools has changed the way that we do this. Humans and chimps are, depending on which study, somewhere between 96 and 98% identity. And so that's really quite close. Like I said, that's closer than horses and zebras. Okay, the rates of evolution. Different parts of genes are more important than others. Okay, we talked about the structure of eukaryotic genes, that you have the 5' untranslated region, the 3' untranslated region. You've got exons, you've got introns, you've got flanking regions. Okay. The most important part of a eukaryotic gene are the regulatory mechanisms, the regulatory sequences, and the exons. Okay. If you start making nucleotide changes in the exons, you start changing the protein sequence. Okay. And protein, if it's working well, there's not much benefit to all of a sudden changing its amino acid sequence. You will tend to get something that is functioning less well. So as a result, you tend to select against detrimental mutations in exons. But some of these untranslated regions, like introns and the 5' and 3' untranslated region, there's less selective pressure on them. As long as the splice junctions on an intron are fine and it gets removed, an intron can pretty much look like anything as long as it's getting spliced out successfully. You can shuffle the sequences in an intron dramatically, and as long as it's not there when it comes time to do translation, it's done the job of an intron. So as a result, over time, if you look at a gene, you see a much higher rate of nucleotide variation in introns and untranslated regions than you do in exons. And so when studies use molecular tools to do it, they have to base it on which part of the gene it is that they're looking at. Okay? And so there's this idea of a molecular clock. These different parts of a genes will have acceptable mutation rates over time, and we can track what those are. So that means if we look at two different samples, if we know the number of nucleotide variations, if we know that the rate of mutation is fairly constant over time, we could use that as an indication of how long it was between those two organisms in terms of when did they diverge evolutionarily. So you can use the idea of constant or near constant mutagenesis or mutation rates to go back and predict times. So you could take those phylogenetic maps and you can associate a time frame with them. When did domestic horses diverge from their common ancestor? You can, instead of just the distance in divergence, we can correlate that with time, and that's referred to as the molecular clock. In humans, the most common way that they do that is looking at the mitochondrial genes. Okay, that there's a certain rate of mutation in the mitochondrial genes. We understand what that is, so if we look at variation between populations, then we can tie that into a time and we can figure out when populations of humans diverge from each other. We can basically do that with organisms once we understand what that base level of mutation is. And so this is just showing proportion of differences in amino acid sequences, so the exon parts of genes, and with these divergences, and then with the timing of the divergences to show that it's a pretty good correlation. Okay. So if we look at a phylogenetic map of distantly related organisms and we apply the molecular clock, now instead of giving a degree of identity or a number of divergences, our axis down here, we can use time to show how many millions of years. So if you want to figure out, this is not saying that humans evolved from dogs. This is saying that at some point in time, humans and dogs had a common ancestor and there was a divergence that eventually led to humans. There was a divergence that originally led to dogs, and that split would have taken place at about 80 million years ago. And so that's what this map is basically showing. So up here, then we've got another mammal, a kangaroo, but it's a marsupial. And then we get more distantly related with birds and salamanders and fish, and then bony fish, and then cartilaginous fish. And so humans and sharks stopped being in the same lineage about 440 million years ago. Okay. So that's the way that we can roughly tie things in on a timeline, is through that mutation rate. Okay, then the last thing that we'll talk about is genome evolution. Okay. We've been focusing on evolution as changes in nucleotide sequences within genes, but genomes themselves evolve over time. I think it's largely one of the most overlooked aspects of evolution. But there are some big events that take place in genomes over time, and it's one of the big differences between eukaryotes and prokaryotes, that prokaryotes, the selective pressure is to maintain the smallest genome possible. So if you take a prokaryote and put it in really permissive conditions, a condition in which it tends to grow really well. There's very little competition. Over time, that bacterial genome will get smaller. I mentioned that one of the bacteria that I work with in my lab, Haemophilus influenzae, it was the first bacterium to have its entire genome sequenced. And when the sequence came out, it was about 1.8 million bases. And it was a strain of Haemophilus influenzae that had been in labs for about 40 years, that it was characterized for some of those restriction enzymes that I talked about. It was pretty good at making those restriction enzymes. Some bacterial physiologists liked some of the aspects of Haemophilus, so it was maintained in a lab. And I was working on a gene cluster that puts carbohydrates out on the outer surface of the bacterium. And I had two genes that were back-to-back. Or actually, they were driven off the same promoter. So we had one promoter, and then we had these two genes. Call them RFAD and F. They were driven off the same promoter and all the clinical isolates that I had. So clinical isolates means I isolated them from somebody that had either cystic fibrosis or had chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. I isolated this bacteria from somebody that had a respiratory tract disease that they were having problems with. And every one of them that I looked at, these two genes were together. When I compared that with the genome that had been sequenced, they had RFAD, they had RFAF, but then they had eight genes in between them. Okay. And in fact, they weren't even driven off the same promoter anymore. So I thought, okay, what's up with that? I looked at, you know, like 25 clinical isolates. All of mine were always like this. The one that they sequenced, they were, you know, I confirmed the sequence and the strain that they had. And then I started looking at other differences between my clinical strains and the strain that was sequenced. I'd cut the DNA up into relatively large fragments, look at how much total DNA was there. And in all my clinical strains, I had about 2.1 million bases. And in their genome, they had 1.8 million bases. And I could go in and I could find entire gaps, typically involved in surviving host immunity. And so their strain of Haemophilus influenzae, the only place that Haemophilus influenzae lives in nature is in the back of the human throat. And they had a strain of Haemophilus influenzae that hadn't been inside of the back of a human throat in 40 years. And it had lost 300,000 base pairs, which corresponds to about 300 genes in bacteria. And essentially, all of them were involved in being successful in a competitive environment in the back of your throat. They had taken this bacterium that had to compete, and now it was in a lab for 40 years where they were giving it all the food that it needed. There were no white blood cells coming around trying to kill it. And so if you're a bacterium growing in this situation, if you've got genes involved in getting by white blood cells, they're just slowing you down if you never see a white blood cell. So if you have an evolutionary event where you lose that DNA, you're going to replicate slightly faster than the guy next to you that's keeping that DNA. And so there's a selection for genome reduction in bacteria. And so we used to think that it would take a long period of time, but then we actually were able to demonstrate that you can lose, so that's about 14% of the genome in less than 30 years. So the rate of genome reduction takes place. Then further work demonstrated that E. coli has about 4 million base pairs. E. coli and Haemophilus influenza had a common ancestor. E. coli can live in the gastrointestinal tract of mammals, but E. coli can also go out and live in pond water or streams. Okay? Haemophilus influenza always has to live in a mammal, specifically a human. But once that common ancestor lost the ability to, it lost one gene needed to live in a pond or a stream, all of the other genes needed to live in that different environment became expendable. At that point, it was already dead-ended. It had to stay inside of mammals. It couldn't go out and live in the outside environment again. Half of its genome became expendable. And so it lost the ability to live that other lifestyle entirely, but it lost half of its genome and it became able to replicate more quickly. So the trend that we tend to see in bacterial genetics is one towards genome reduction to the smallest possible genome suitable for the breadth of the environment. If you have an organism that only sees one environment, like 37 degrees, a lot of iron, nice humidity like the back of your throat, it can have a really narrow small genome. An organism that lives in a wide range of environments will have a larger genome. What happens with eukaryotes is the opposite. Over time, we tend to see genome padding, an increase in the complexity and the size of genomes over time with eukaryotes. And so some of that takes place by duplication events. Remember when we talked about duplications, that the role of duplications in evolution is important. You then have an extra copy of a gene that can be altered by mutation without losing the original function of the first gene. And again, in bacteria, horizontal gene transfer. Horizontal gene transfer does occur in eukaryotes by viral infection, where viral sequences can incorporate into the chromosome. With humans, there's a significant number of things that evolutionarily look like viral sequences, but we're at the lesser end of the scale, that there's some organisms that have a lot of these highly repetitive viral-like sequences in their genomes. It's just showing how some of the globin genes came from a common ancestor. There were duplications, changes over time, so you get myoglobin and you get beta and alpha globin gene clusters. So duplication is important to allow for evolution and variation. If you only had a single copy of that gene and you start altering it via mutation, you lose function and it may be selected against. All right, so that's what I've got. So today, you ought to understand genome reduction and why that works, allopatric and sympatric speciation, and then the differences between looking at molecular basis of phylogenetics with physiological. All right? And then either see you on Thursday or on Monday.